You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Well, hello, Vivian.
Hi, Mike. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, a pleasure to be here.
So, Vivian, for those who haven't come across you online, tell our listeners who you are and why we're talking.
I'm Vivian Juder Frankel, and I am the founder of Pharma Salon, a conference company that I started in early 2020.
How would you define a conference?
I would define a conference as an educational forum for busy professionals.
I'm trying to think, like, what other things do people get together for business-wise that they don't call a conference? They never just say, we're going to get together for the hell of it and drink a lot of beer, right? I guess that would be called a party. So almost everything would be kind of considered a conference, or at least that's what they're telling the IRS and telling themselves, that they're going to a conference, right?
Yeah, I think the other thing that people would get together for are trade shows. And often within a trade show, you have a conference.
I was going to say that a show, and a show would be more of the table set up and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I associate trade shows with, you know, a couple, I guess it could be, you know, from 500 to, you know, 100,000 people. You know, it's a big event where you traipse around a room looking at all the exhibitors, looking at their tables. And depending on the size of the trade show, you know, you might just go for the trade show portion, or you might, there's usually some sort of conference attached to it as well.
The trade shows are usually huge. A conference, you wouldn't necessarily have to have those kind of numbers to call it a conference, right?
I mean, I've had conferences with 35 people.
How short would you call something to be a conference? Could it be an hour, or is it usually like a day or a weekend, those kind of things?
I don't know if there is really a definition. I think an hour would be more like a class. You know what I mean? I think you need at least several sessions. I have seen some events that are half-day events. I think they're probably more called seminars. I mean, you're getting really down into the nitty-gritty.
We have all kinds of things we can call them.
Where's that line between a seminar and a conference? I mean, you know, I don't know, because like I said, I've had small conferences, but could they also be called a seminar if you have 35 people? Yes, even though it's over 25. And honestly, that goes into your marketing as well. Like, if I know I have a niche audience, I might choose to call it, and we're always going to be small and intimate, we might choose to call it a seminar.
You can really call it whatever the hell you want, as long as the people don't come and expect something different. You probably don't want to call it a conference when there's maybe five people coming.
Oh, I have.
Oh, you have?
I didn't want five people. That's what showed up.
How low would you go and call it a conference still?
Obviously, your objective is never five people. You know, I've called things seminars and I've called things workshops. Workshop, I think, implies a certain amount of interactivity. And then, you know, you bring up the other issue, which is goals and outcomes. The goal is always going to be probably to have, I would say 35 is the minimum. 20 is, yeah, you're getting more down into a seminar. I guess for me, maybe a conference, it depends on the room layout. If you've got a bunch of round tables and people in the front of the stage, then you're doing it. But once you talk to maybe a situation where, you know, you have those rooms that are in giant squares, you know, maybe that's too small to be calling a conference.
That's interesting. With my podcast here, when I started it, I said, I want to have X amount of listeners every week. That X to me was just personal. And I said, would I spend this amount of time if someone said to me, you're going to go and talk to these amount of people in Grand Rapids, this many people will be sitting in the room. And I would say, okay, I'd like it to be about X. That makes sense for me. Well, the podcast has done better than X. But at some point, if it's below X, you start saying, well, I guess it's almost like feedback. It's like, well, I should have at least X, you know? So Vivian, we're going to go deeper, but I want to know this. You must have had some embarrassing times, right? Like me inviting people to my 7-year-old birthday party and nobody showing up. I'm just I'm just kidding. A little drama. My mom came, you know, so yes. that was good.
Well, there you go.
Do you have a horror story of having a conference or a meeting through no fault of your own, of course?
Well, that's the thing about corporations. It's not my fault. It was marketing's fault.
It's marketing's fault. I got to blame it on somebody.
I've had two epic disasters, and they're both humiliating and upsetting because you're not the only one involved. But, and you bring up a point, which is about canceling. One of them, it was for my own company, Mom's Making Money. I did two in California that were hugely successful, and I decided to take it across country and go to Connecticut. Again, to blame, not my fault, of course.
No, of course not.
To blame my PR team. They let the side down. And for whatever reason, not many people showed up. And it's hard. It's very hard when you put your heart and soul into something like that, because that was all me. The other disaster I had was in San Diego, and I was doing an event on in healthcare, in devices. And I was pretty excited about the agenda. I thought it was a great agenda. It was a really great roster of speakers. And we literally had two paid attendees. And that was really hard because now you've got 10, 15 people who've prepared, because it was a full 2-day event, who've prepared presentations, taken time out of their day, come to San Diego, you know, for two people. And I will say the speakers were enormously gracious. One was kind of a jerk, and he was from San Diego, so it wasn't even that big of a deal. He didn't know there were only two attendees. I mean, there were 25 people in the room because of the speakers.
You incentivized all the speakers to stick around for everybody else's program, you know, right?
Oh, I did. Yes.
Typically, a speaker's not going to go to every presentation.
Exactly. And they did all feel a little obligated to show up. I think everybody. But on another level, it was actually great. So we set it up and moved it to a seminar format. That's what made me think of the round table. You know, we took everything out of the room. The hotel graciously moved us to a smaller room, and we set things up in that, you know, square. And the speakers would give the presentations, and you know, this, and you got to remember, speakers are also attendees. Like, there are things they want to learn, and they were so incredibly gracious and nice and supportive, because they were like, all the speakers here are fantastic. The content is fantastic. And even my two attendees wrote, actually, they were from the same company, but they wrote a testimonial saying we were a little upset when we got there and saw that the, you know, so few people, but it turned out to be a great event because people were very comfortable exchanging ideas and having dialogue and, you know, and cross-talking and things like that. And a lot of those speakers came to other events of mine after that and things like that. So organizationally, it was solid. Like I said, they respected the agenda. I think the problem, I mean, I did a lot of, you know, we did a lot of evaluation with my managers at the time. It was kind of an event that was thrown together last minute, which I can do as a producer, but marketing struggles with. It was one of those conferences that the corporate powers that be decided they needed another event in December. So it was like mid-December, not a lot of love given to it.
Is there anything that you say, this will never happen again because of XYZ, or could that happen again?
Since that one was more corporate, I was less out of my control. Given my experience with the Moms Making Money event in Connecticut, and I thought about, it's complicated because again, this was my own business, so it's all my own money. You know, I've already put down all the money for the food and the hotel and spent all the money on the marketing and all, you know, I did have a couple of, you know, exhibitors/sponsors, things like that. So you always have to weigh, you know, what's the embarrassment and the dissatisfaction going to be versus the money that I've already spent and having to give back all that money and so on and so forth. But I would say the personal, I was so upset over the way that event went. And again, the people who went there enjoyed it, but some of the speakers were not as gracious, to be honest, as the professionals in San Diego. And I would cut my losses. That was my what I learned out of that. Cut your losses.
If that happened again and you had two people show up, would you cancel it?
No, if I had two people going into the event like a week beforehand, I would cancel the event.
Like on that one, did you know that only two people were coming? When did you find that out?
I knew because, yeah, you're always kept abreast of who's registered.
And now if you'd have done that over, you would have canceled it.
Well, that event, again, it's a little bit different because of corporate dollars involved. But, you know, moving forward, I have my own company. I think I would have canceled it, yes. Or what I would have done, I believe that knowledge, to quote a much overly used phrase, knowledge is power. I also believe that the key to success is managing expectations. And what I think I would do differently is email all the speakers. Just give them a heads up. Like, there are not a lot of people here. If you don't want to come, I totally get it. We'll, you know, you'll be missed. Maybe you could record your presentation and at least I can do that, you know, air that or send out the presentation to people, things like that. I don't know. You know, you have to play every event kind of in it as its own thing. But the complexity is that was two people. But what if you have 10 people? You know, you're still kind of like, ugh. But now you've got 10 people who've paid for flights and paid for hotels. And they're not getting their money back. So unless you're prepared to reimburse them for their flights and everything, you know, so it's a difficult balance of which I don't know if there's, I have a general rule, I'd have to play it by ear.
A lot of it is, like you say, the perception. I mean, if it was built more as a seminar kind of thing or this or that or breakout groups, if you had 8 or 10, that's different than saying you've got this 3-day event and your radio ads got that echo going for like the big monster truck and then just a few people are there. All right. Yes. So, Vivian, you went to school in Boston for poli-sci government. Where was that jump to say, I'm going to do this?
My first event was with the Botswana National Volleyball Association. And I was helping them put on this international tournament with 12 countries. And it was, to date, the craziest, most fun event ever.
So what are you doing over in Africa?
I finished college and wanted to travel the world. Ended up in South Africa, you know, met a boy, moved in with him in Botswana. We started a chain of retail stores called Sunglasses and Things. And we had about 5 stores. And while I was doing the 5 stores, didn't love retail. I remember one time I was yelling, this is what I loved about Botswana. I was yelling at one of the shopping mall managers about how there wasn't enough traffic. It was a new mall. And I was yelling at him about not having enough traffic for my store. And he finally turned to me and said, well, if you think you can do a better job, go right ahead. So he hired me and I started doing, you know, promotional events to bring people into the mall. And that led me to the Botswana Volleyball Association. Yeah, it was fun.
Then you came back. Then you said, hey, I can offer my services, because you weren't always self-employed with that. You were working for companies as their events person.
Yeah, the first time I went out on my own was for Moms Making Money. I kind of looked back and I said, I really enjoy events. I enjoy bringing people together. And I also say part of the reason I like events is I enjoy talking to people who are smarter than me. And I enjoy learning about a lot.
It's my whole life. The only one that doesn't fit in that category is probably my dog, Lady. But besides that, I've always got that slanted against me.
Yeah, me too.
With the events, you're working with what? People that know a lot about events, or they know about the subject matter they're going to talk about?
They know about the subject matter, which I find really interesting. So when I put together Moms Making Money, I wanted to do events, but I also wanted to help women like me, you know, who were not ready or could not, or, you know, were not able to go into the, you know, back into work because, you know, I was part of a mom's club and there would be these women always crying saying, now I got to go back to my job or whatever it was. So I wanted to help them figure out how it was that you could establish an income from home. So we had not a sophisticated, but 2 basic tracks, which is 1, jobs you could do from home. And the other one was, you know, helping women start their own business from home. And it was, you know, it was fun.
Did you have events then to grow that business then?
I did. And the reason why it became so overwhelming was I started with events, but I didn't stay with just events. Because as everything, you know, you kind of want to stay in front of people and stuff like that. And I started a podcast. So I was an early podcaster, 2003. So we started a podcast. I started local meetups. I created a workbook called Birthing Your Business. And I tried to arrange it so people could get together and, you know, who wanted to start their own business and kind of provide a support group while they worked through their workbook and stuff like that. So there was a lot going on.
All that stuff is going on. And then that subsides. You don't do that anymore. And then when do you say, all right, I'm going to do events as my main thing going forward? Did you do that through a company then, or did you start doing some of your own?
I got hired, you know, so Bombs Making Money kind of provided me a back into the market, you know, kind of box on my resume. So when I was prepared to go back full time, so I started working with a company that did events in the life sciences, but for academia. And I think did things like conferences on aging and conferences on metabolic health and conferences on the gut. I can't even frankly remember because they were all highly scientific. When I left that company, I was freelancing for a company based out of the UK, putting again on these academic events.
To get those jobs, are you responding to a call out? I mean, are you sending your resume and stuff in, or are you going into these companies and saying, here's what I can do for you. You don't have this yet. They needed an event person.
They were established event companies. So you have your basic event companies and they just hire producers like myself to come in and create these agendas and book speakers and stuff like that.
Oh, they have the company and then you're coming in, when you say producer, almost like producing a separate, like a producer would a movie. You've got a different producer for every event.
Exactly. Exactly. Now it's interesting how things have changed. So originally as a producer, I was in charge of finding the topic, narrowing down the topic, finding the speakers, putting together the agenda. In charge of all the media partnerships, in charge of all the marketing, everything. But it seemed like the position evolved to my last few jobs. All I did was book the speakers in the agenda and create the agenda. You know, marketing, partnerships, all that other stuff was left to other people.
Are most of the speakers paid or unpaid?
Depends on the company. The companies I worked for were predominantly unpaid. Big names and things like that. You asked to be paid.
Because it's helping those people get exposure to that demographic, that market, and so on.
I find speakers have a lot of different reasons why they present. Some just like it. Some like, you know, I think some are doing it for their resume to get their name out and become, you know, more well known in their field. I feel like they do it as well because they like the conference, because, you know, you always have to sell your event to them. So they like the conference and they like the idea. So they also want to come and learn and talk to other people.
How do you write that in the presentation to them? Do you come out and say this is a non-paid thing or?
No.
They know it's not unless you say something like, how much do you charge or something, right?
Yeah. Or usually it's the other way around. They'll be like, how much are you paying me? And they'll be like,
You don't bring it up. If they bring it up.
I don't bring it up.
If they bring it up, then you say, we're not paying you anything. And then some will say, okay. And some will say, no, I need something.
Or depending on the name and the situation, I might pay them.
What's that fee that you pay to get into a
place? Registration?
Yeah. It could be a reduced registration or maybe pay for.
The registration is free.
Oh, that's free. So when they come, that's free. And that's a lot of money sometimes.
This is what I like to think is they want to be part of the event and they want to go to the event and they're not being charged for that. Somebody once did tell me, and this was a couple of years ago, so I don't know if it was a model people were trying and didn't go anywhere, but they tried charging speakers. And I was like, I've never heard of that. I was like, no. I mean, I think that's probably a different type of event.
There's some podcasts that charge guests to be on their show.
I get it because it's they're setting it up as a marketing thing.
You know, they're saying, look, I've got thousands of listeners. And so if I'm going to bring someone on, I think they usually do it when they've got so many people that want to do it that they say, what's it worth to everybody?
And to be clear, there are positions often reserved for sponsors, speaking slots. But I think most companies are very careful about that because nobody wants, as an attendee, you don't want to be like, I just paid to hear a bunch of people pitch me.
So you're saying some companies have spots for people to pay to come.
Yeah, the sponsors is part of the sponsorship package.
Oh, if they sponsor, they'll get a speaker.
Yeah, they'll get a speaking spot. But, you know, and we always do try to say like, okay, you've got the speaker spot, but please don't use this as an hour-long commercial for your company. And I would say my experience is that most are pretty careful, but there are some that sometimes are like terrible. And that's all they do. And it pisses off the attendees. I mean, and rightfully so. They didn't come to be pitched.
it's got to be hard to put a limit on that or a number. Like, you can't say, all right, saying your business name this many times is meaning that you've gone overboard, but only saying it once. You know what I mean? I mean, look, at people aren't stupid. The speaker knows if he's getting up and he's trying to put on a sales pitch or not, but they might think they're trying to pull one over on you guys. What would be something where you start saying, oh, crap, or you start shaking your head? Because you've seen it, right? You've seen someone get up there and try to pitch your company too much?
Yeah, there's nothing you can do about it. As a corporate line, they always say, well, we won't invite them back. But, you know, your business is making money. You're not going to say no. You try to talk to them and say, tone it down. There was this one guy, I did a healthcare conference, and he came in last minute, and the sponsor people asked me to put him on. He wasn't sponsoring my event. He was sponsoring another event, but he was interested in this. And they're like, can you put him on? And I had a speaker slot available, so I said yes. And then we decided to do something at lunchtime, like round tables or something. So I said, do you want to kind of introduce that and, you know, launch that? And he said, yeah, I would love to. And he was an entrepreneur and had a lot of great experience and a lot of great businesses and very knowledgeable in the field. So I was like, okay, great. The guy literally spent 15 minutes out of our 45-minute lunch where people are supposed to eat and network and like have conversations with each other talking about himself. And I was like trying to cut him off, and I'm trying to figure, like, good God, when is he going to talk? He talked about himself and his businesses and what they were doing and how successful they were. And I'm like, I was tearing my hair out, you know, I literally was like walking up to him trying to take the microphone from him.
Was he even trying to promote money stuff, or did he just have a stage for himself to brag about himself?
I think so, because it wasn't like these people weren't even really their target audience. I think he was just... You know, I have an uncle who's a producer. He has produced movies and plays and musicals. And whenever he's in the fundraising stage, his motto is talk to everybody. Sell yourself to every single person you come across. Never, ever stop. And like I said, it's worked for him. And I feel like that was this guy's kind of, I don't know if it was a conscious decision, but that's kind of what it is. And, you know, and again, hats off to him, you know, running your own business and being entrepreneurial and securing funds and getting everything out there does take a lot of work. But it was, you know, I just feel like it was endless and tireless self-promotion. And yes, we got the feedback saying he was terrible.
That theory of, you know, well, it doesn't hurt, talk to everybody. It's like, well... Yeah, if you want to be known as kind of an asshole, who wants to be known as that?
I'm just going to say, I think my uncle probably does it a lot more with a lot more finesse.
Yeah, I'm sure. There's a few different ways to do it, too.
I mean, and yeah, he just took up like half the lunchtime. I was like, dude, nobody wants to sit here and listen to you talk about your businesses.
Vivian, you know what should be against the law, I decided?
What?
Best man speeches. Those should. I mean, look at the combination you got. You've got a friend who is drunk, probably has never... been in front of a microphone too often.
Yeah.
He's not a comedian, but he thinks he is after a few beers. Well, here's what I say, at least. If they don't do away with them, they should have clearance, you know, like you have to read it and you've got to get authorization or something, because that's a tragedy.
I'm going to tell you a funny story. Normally, I would agree with you, but you do have... So my brother is an exceptional speaker. And he's just a really funny, endearing guy. And he does everything off the cuff. And my brother got married. My other brother, I have two brothers. When he got married, he did that. He's like, I want to see what you're going to write. You have to write it out.
Really?
Because I need to approve it. And my brother was so upset. He's like, I can't work that way. I can't function. And, you know, it's just not the way he thinks is to write out a whole speech. So he tried to do it. And he like started reading it, and it was just a disaster. It was the worst speech ever. But I mean, I get what you're saying. There, I mean, he's the exception to the rule because he's a natural off-the-cuff speaker.
My best man, and unfortunately, we don't see eye to eye anymore. But I knew before he got up there that he was probably going to say something a little off color and things like that. What I probably shouldn't have done is... ever had that situation. Probably never had him as my best man. So I think a lot of it is don't pick someone like that. Do you think your other brother had any reason to believe that your brother would do this? Or do you think he listened to advice from someone like me who, you know, didn't know?
You know, I never really thought about it. And now that you mention it, I wonder if he took advice from his now wife, because we're all like, ugh. And she is just the most... Ugh. So I wonder if she was like, you can't let Joe say whatever he wants.
Why do businesses have conferences? You mentioned it earlier, like one wanted to get it in before their end of the year.
It is a business. I mean, that is the business. So there's two types of events. One is somebody like, I did some work for NVIDIA. You know them, the chip company. And they have a annual event for their developers. I think it was called the GD, I forget what it was called. So you have the corporations who put on their own events, and then you have companies that are just event companies that say, you know what, I can make money putting on an event.
Oh, it's a profit game.
Yes. So they just say, and then you have a corporation like what who I was working for, you know, and their whole goal was to put on 120 events a year.
Wow.
Which is a lot.
In pharmacy, we had to go every year to our wholesalers dog and pony show because they would give like a few percentage points on your buying for the whole year if you went to the convention, the trade show.
This goes back to what we were talking about, the pitch sessions. I'm assuming that, did they have a conference attached to that, or was it just the trade show?
It was a conference attached to it. I never went to those. I don't know. I guess the hotel room seemed more attractive to me than sitting at
conferences. Yeah.
The three or four main wholesalers do it. They make you go. It's a crap load of money to go to, but they say you save that in your percentage off buying through the year. Let's say it costs you $1,000 to go. Maybe you save $2,000 or $3,000 by purchasing discounts, not even buying there, just through the year. They give you this discount because you went to the trade show. So I guess those conferences and stuff, they're money things, but some probably don't do them for money. They do them for exposure.
The corporate events, like the one you're describing, like I think NVIDIA, I mean, I don't know if they make money. I was never part of that business model, but I think it's more to get people in the room to find a message, right? Because, you know, like all these companies, big corporations have big events, and sometimes they're internal for their people. And sometimes, like you said, like that in NVIDIA, I think it was external. You know, like how Apple, you can develop stuff for, you know, apps for the iPhone. NVIDIA had the same thing. They had open sourced information. So you could bring in all these people who just wanted to learn various things about the chips and stuff like that. I don't know if they're designed as moneymakers. I don't even know what, like NVIDIA, I don't even know what they charge people to come in. I'm sure they want to at least break even. Like, you know, it's not a loss leader. And I know there's, you know, they're charging money to attend. So, but whether the goal is for profit, I think the goal is more for marketing and publicity, but whether they figure they can make a profit at it as well, I don't know. But for companies like Informa is a huge international conference company based out of the UK. I mean, that's their whole business. And I mean, it's huge. And they've got like fingers in almost every pie, you know, healthcare, the life sciences, defense, what finance, you know, whatever. That's all they do is produce conferences. I lie. Informa also produces publications. So lately, there's been a big tie in between publishing and conferences. The two support each other very nicely. So
I've always have seen conferences that have been by the company, you know, by the wholesalers and so on. And I think maybe they don't advertise much to pharmacies that way because most people probably aren't going to go to two or three. You know, they've got the wholesaler, and maybe they've got their national association, something like that. But I understand what you're talking about. And would this be similar to like a home and garden show or something in town, you know, like a trade show that might be put on by a company who just does these things and they make money from them, but similar, but for a conference.
Right. So my background is technology. So let me know if you remember, but you remember things like Internet World or CES. These are massive technology conferences. CES still goes on, but that's like a private company.
South by Southwest, something like that.
Exactly. All these things are just private companies that are like, I'm going to get people together and make money from it.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure South by Southwest makes tons of money.
If you took a poll of the average person walking around a trade show or a conference, and you said, compared to 2 weeks ago when you were back at your office or back in your hometown or something, is this a positive thing to be here or a negative thing to be here? You think the participants like it, or it's just a pain in the ass for them and they have to go because of their company or something?
I think most participants choose to go. For the conferences, they choose to go. They have to apply to their company to allow them to go because they have to justify the costs, the time away, things like that, because it's not their vacation. Whether they enjoy it or not, of course, boils down to the event, the success of the event. On a good event, I think most people would walk away saying, yeah, I think it's an opportunity. There are a couple of things you get out of conferences. Is you get the opportunity to learn more about what you're doing. And let's face it, in business, there are a lot of managers or executives who, and I don't say this is a negative, this is just life, is there is a lot of things, you know, a lot of decisions have to be made, and you don't always feel like you know all the facts, or, you know, you want to see what somebody else is doing and how somebody else has managed it. So it provides an opportunity to learn from other people. It's an opportunity to get out of the office and to hang out with some colleagues.
That's a big part of it too, isn't it?
Large conferences can do things that are kind of fun because they have the money. You know, throw into all these extracurricular activities, like big parties. Like, you know, again, when I was going to big trade shows, there was a big party to go to every night, you know, or a dinner or things like that. But for smaller events, you always have the, you know, you have your networking breaks, lunch, and the gratuitous cocktail party.
A typical conference that's not a trade show, they don't have like fun things planned usually.
No. I mean, some people try, but yeah, no, the fun thing is your So figure most events are 2-day events. So the first day, you know, for the 2 days, you'll get breakfast, you get lunch, you get 15 to 30 minute coffee breaks. And then at the end of day one, you have a cocktail party, which is about an hour to an hour and a half, which half the people don't stay for.
Pre-dinner or after dinner or what?
Pre-dinner, as soon as the conference ends. So if the conference ends at 5, the cocktail is like 5 to 6:30.
And then people, because it's a 2-day event, if they're out of town, they might go to dinner or something like that afterwards.
But it's usually left up to their own devices. And I've seen organizations, and again, I think this is done mostly with the bigger one. Like people have set up sign-up sheets and things like that. You know, if you want to go to, you know, like, you know, if you want to go to dinner with somebody, put your name down here and we'll try to match people. But it's, I don't know how successful those things are.
But most of them don't have nighttime things.
Correct. I'm trying to plan one. My dream event that I'm planning for September is in Park City. And I want to do a tour of a distillery and dinner. Right? How fun would that be?
People going to these conferences, they might apply for them. Then they go. I imagine that people probably like to go to some, but you wouldn't want to go to one every week. Because then you'd probably get behind on your stuff. A couple times a year, though.
It's an interesting question. I've never actually asked, maybe I should start doing that, how many conferences people go to a year.
My dad always said, because we're from Grand Rapids, Michigan, he'd always say, how come they never have, he was joking, how come they never have these in Detroit? They're always down in Florida, you know, but people like the warm weather, right? They like to travel a little bit, things like that.
I think there are two schools of thought. One is the destination event and one is the convenience event.
They're usually opposite, right?
Exactly. So for example, a lot of, you know, when you're planning, and this is the producer's job as well, is to identify a location that they think. So you try to take into account where everybody's going to come from, you know, are the flights going to be difficult? Do they need to do, is most people going to need to do transfers? How far is the hotel from the airport? You know, or is the hotel in a place where people can wander around? Because as we discussed, they do have some time available, like in the evenings, you know, can they leave the hotel and go find something to eat? And then certainly the weather, like, you know, even Detroit and, you know, even though Detroit may be easily accessible, nobody wants to go to Detroit in January.
I don't think they want to go to Detroit in July. We have a little rivalry going on this side of the state to that side of the state. Of course, Grand Rapids is trying to make their mark. We can't have huge things, but we've got the Amway boys, you know, and they're always trying to bring stuff here.
You're seeing a lot more smaller cities, I think, are becoming popular. Nashville in the last, like, I remember when I was at a company 4 years ago, I tried to do an event in Nashville and they refused. They said it was too hard to get to because I was like, it's right in the middle for everybody. And next thing I know, Nashville, like all these events are happening in Nashville because it's a hotbed. I've looked at Louisville, Denver, we did events. I'm not such a fan of Denver because I think it's too far from the airport. You know, these are the things you take into account, trying to balance what people like. And, you know, because you got to remember also, like we did an event in Park City, which I thought was fantastic, but no, there wasn't any time for anybody to do anything. And if you're at an event all day long, you know, and people do come and go, like they feel like they've taken their 2 days off. They don't, you know, they're rarely going to spend another day or so.
Where were you working at this time last year?
I was working for a company based out of North Carolina, and I was about to leave them. So yeah, I left them in February.
What kind of events were they doing?
Healthcare. I did healthcare and finance for them. They were into those two different verticals.
But they were one of those companies that did events.
Yeah, we did events in a lot in managed healthcare, which is a huge, you know, like Medicare, enormously complicated. Then, like I said, I also did some stuff. I also did stuff in finance.
Boy, but that's a hoot going to one of those.
Yeah, yeah. But they, and I think they did some legal stuff.
Which people are more boring, the healthcare people or the finance people?
Neither. They were both super fun.
All right. I know when to move on. I thought I could get you.
Yeah. I mean, these are dry topics, but the people behind them are passionate and interesting. So
that's true. All right. So it's this time last year.
And I make the grand decision to quit my job.
You know, looking back at your early Twitter stuff, one of your early tweets was COVID, I think.
Wow, you really did go through all my stuff. I rarely.
Oh, psh, heck yeah. Go through everything. One of your early things was COVID. You'd quit your job. All of a sudden, you've got people that can't go to conferences. And it almost seems like you had like a crystal ball. Like, I mean, it seems like that would be the time to do this, but it wasn't. You already had your job quitting plan. Did you already have Farm Salon in your mind before this?
I registered Farm Salon in like October 2019. Yes, I had been planning on it for a while. I was extremely unhappy in my work situation. Not so much the topics, but very, you know, unhappy with my managers and enormously stressed out.
Managers suck. A lot of managers suck. Why is that?
They do suck. I think this one was just threatened. And yes, feel free to publish that. She was younger than me and she was the worst. You know, always like, I know everything I do is right. You've worked at one company your entire life. Don't tell me that, you know. Anyway.
It's all self-preservation, it seems.
Yeah. And you know what? It's the feudal system. Everybody very, you know, protects their little area.
Yeah.
And they have to be king.
Yeah, they have to be king of their area.
I'm not built that way. I'm, you know, they always talk about teamwork, but I truly am a team player. And I was looking forward to working with organizations to be able to have a team. You know, again, you don't want to be an island. Like, I didn't want to be an island. I wanted to be somebody who could like talk to my marketing person and say, oh, you know, maybe we should try this or maybe we should try this. And, you know, what do you think of this topic? Like, talk to my manager, who supposedly had more experience than I did, and be like, what do you think of this topic? Or let me kind of tease something out with you. And all I ever got was either that's wrong, and then figure it out on your own. And I got this from my two last jobs, so which really kind of embittered me to corporate life. Not that I ever was a fan, but
I haven't been in a corporation ever really. It's always been our family business. I run things as a benevolent dictator and heavy on the dictator and not so sure about the benevolency. I've never been in the corporate politics, but I know they would drive me
bonkers.
Batty, I'm sure. Okay, so I would look at this and I would say, well, Vivian, you did all this because of COVID and stuff. You're like, no, I was going to quit my job. I had Pharma Salon. How far back had you gotten that name, let's say?
Like I said, I think it was around October of 2019.
All right, so bring me through your thought process.
That made me want to do it?
We already know you hated your...
Well, that wasn't the only reason manager. Why. I mean, that was certainly a motivating factor.
Oh, I think you should do things out of spite. That's how you get successful.
That's why I will be moving into healthcare next.
All right, so...
I was in this business and I've always done smaller events, less than 100 people. And this, I think, was a little bit of the rub between me and the corporations. Like, they had this girl come in, and she always did these large trade shows. And, you know, she thought she knew everything. Because people, and I hear this a lot, people think that quantity translates to quality. So if I do bigger events with more people and more everything, I clearly know more than you. Because you only do small events with a small amount of people and only one or two tracks, which to me is like they're just two different animals. And I really wanted to, and when I had joined this company, to be honest, I thought they were open. You know, they said they were trying to build their thing and they wanted to do things different and they wanted to do things interesting and stuff like that. And I was like excited because I felt like small events, too many people looked at smaller events and made them look like a trade show conference. You know what I mean? Like you have your people, a person on the stage, you have presentation, 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 and then you do it all the next day. And maybe like a, you know, a fireside chat or a panel discussion. But there's no difference other than scale to the way a 100-person event was arranged to a 5,000-person event was arranged. And I felt like that was just wrong because when you're selling a smaller event, part of the reason that you say is a certain amount of intimacy, right? You get to meet everybody. You get to kind of talk to everybody. And, you know, you're just selling this much more, going back to what we were talking about, networking, a kind of a getting closer to everybody there. But they never really provided the format to do that. And whenever I tried doing that, I was kicked back saying, well, that's not the way it's done.
The 5,000 versus 100 can be a lot different. But unless you take advantage of those differences, you're just the little sibling of the bigger one, and people are going to say, "Ah, it was okay, but it wasn't real big." And it's like, unless you take advantage of that smallness, people are always going to just say you were the underdog.
There are things to be had out of a small event. And so when I started Pharma Salon, the whole idea was to make things that better enable the exchange of ideas. Because the other thing that I always say is that the people on the stage, 9 times out of 10, are the same level of experience as the people in the audience. I mean, you'll have some junior people who are there to learn, but it doesn't mean they don't have anything to offer either, you know, even if they have good questions or probing questions. So why not maximize all of the education in the room or all the experience in the room? So I wanted to set up events that allowed for more back and forth conversation. Yes, we have our presentations, and yes, we have our panels, and yes, we have our fireside chats. But I also wanted to make sure that we have room for people to exchange ideas with the guy next to them, as well, and in that process, they get to better know everybody in the room. You know, if you're constantly moving tables and things like that, and just make the whole thing a lot more experiential than I'm just going to sit and listen to a didactic presentation where I sit and take notes and review the notes and, you know, report back to my company what the speaker said.
You say you want these smaller things. Tell me why you picked pharmacy. Did you see a hole more in pharmacy? In other words, why didn't you pick dental or why didn't you pick medical equipment? Why is this called Pharma Salon? Why the pharmacist?
Because when I was at one of my previous corporate jobs, we actually started an event on compounding pharmacy. And it came because I was in life sciences and we were doing something for the pharmaceutical industry in terms of again, labs or production, I forget what it was. I'm still not really, you know, jack of all trades, master of none. Jack of all terms, master of none. And the guy talked to me, he turned to me and he said, you know who could really use these events are compounding pharmacies because the industry is relatively newly regulated and a lot of people are in denial. A lot of the labs and the pharmacists and the pharmacies are in denial about being invested in, you know, inspected by the FDA.
They got so hard on things back 10 years ago, right? They got a lot more rules and things.
Well, you know what I'm talking about? That big event where all those people died from a compounding pharmacy?
Yeah, right.
The big meningitis event.
Yeah, pharmacists know how to shoot themselves. That guy left out the vaccine overnight.
I read that was deliberate.
I'm glad it wasn't me because I'd like, no, it wasn't deliberate. I just forgot. But
yeah, I think that's what the story they went for. But then he said, no, I did it on purpose.
2 days in a row.
But that's the whole point. There's so many processes and things that can slip you up, you know, like air quality in the lab or, you know, where do you even get gowned up, inside or outside? Where do you wash your hands? There are all these like little details that nobody ever had to deal with. Anyway, so this guy from Eli Lilly had suggested it and we did an event and it went really well. It was really fun. We had, you know, FDA speakers coming and engaging and everybody there said they were looking for more of these events. And, you know, you've got the association events, but again, those are the big trade shows, and you have like individual small kind of state events, I found out, but there's not a lot of conferences as there is in every other industry, you know, for healthcare, for pharmaceutical, for medical devices that bring all these people together in this kind of format. So when I left my company, I was like, I really enjoyed the compounding pharmacy space. I still had my contacts. So it was kind of, you know, there's a lot, there's a balance of what's really interesting and what can I realistically get into having zero contacts. So I went into the compound pharmacy space. And there is, you know, there's the big player, which is the one that I started, which is the compounding pharmacy compliance. They do it twice a year. So I kind of had to figure out how to manage injecting myself in the middle of all that. And the online space worked out really well. And then it coincided with, you know, COVID kind of rocketing me forward.
COVID helped.
It was both a detriment and not a detriment. It helped in the beginning. And now everybody's burnt out on Zoom because there are so many events.
Interesting. All right. Got to break this down a little bit.
There's a lot to process.
First of all, these pharmacy conferences, because they force you to go to the one, the dog and pony show with the wholesaler, which you don't have enough like-minded people together there. You just got the wholesaler trying to do this. That's one. Then you've got the state association overnighter, you know, where you go for regulatory things, but it's more general. It's more general pharmacy stuff. If they force you to go to the wholesaler one, and then there's some other stuff going on, we talked earlier about how many would people like to go to. And I think that what you're saying then is people were saying that they liked some of these when they went there, but you might have a half hour of compounding or whatever other subject it would be. You might have a half hour of it, but then the rest of it is going to all the other stuff at the conference, and that people could use more of that and then more interaction with other people there.
And other people specifically in their field, because if you're at a big trade show, like you said, that's pharmacy, you know, how are you going to necessarily, other than, like you said, going to that half hour, how are you going to identify who else is in the compounding pharmacy space?
What's the dream? Tell me where you want to see this.
So my original idea is that we would provide a deeper dive, which is maybe you have a presentation, then you have a panel, and then you have a round table. So each time kind of drills down a little bit more into a topic, ending with the round table where people can really kind of say, this is what we learned from the two previous things. And like I said, loosely, like it might just be presentation and round table. This is what we learned from the presentation, but let's all talk about how that's relevant to us. Was that useful? Do you have any other experience that, you know, you think would be relevant to this topic or any other questions? And the idea was that you would have an expert at each table. So let's say you do have a questions, you know, maybe you have an expert that can answer those questions, or, and like I said, and the other people can chime in. So that was really the dream. So our first event, we'd put a couple presentations and a couple panels. And then what I did, because the other opportunity with the round tables is to also be more niche events. And so what I did was I had 6 round tables in one time slot, you know, because, you know, you break things down into 3 hours or whatever. And you can choose the table that you want to talk about, a topic that you want to talk about with other people. This was all online. This was in August where, you know, Zoom, I think, was, you know, all of a sudden super out of control because everybody had been using it and there weren't a lot of options. And people were still learning a bunch of things. We had one of those services, you know, when you go to trade shows, you can download an app that helps you see who else is there and network with people and meet people. So they tried to pivot online as well, which I thought would be great because that way I had all the, you know, you could add your agenda and you could just click on the link in the agenda on the app. And because otherwise we would have had to send out different links to everybody. At least that's what we thought in the beginning, you know, that it would all be a different link. And then Zoom introduced breakout rooms, so that actually became a little less needed. So anyway, we had everybody accessing through the app, which worked for all the main kind of stage presentations, but it didn't work for the breakout room. So I had 75 people in 6 breakout rooms unable to get in. That was a big kind of learning experience on that one. And then just also the benefit is that it's such a big learning experience and doing what I wanted to do since it hasn't been done, you know, is a learning experience. And people were generous. you know, like they know we're all trying something new and I'm trying a different format. I learned like a bunch of tables, some of the speakers, they didn't complain, but they were a little disappointed because they didn't get the interaction that they'd hoped for from the people in the on the table. Some of the groups said, yeah, we had a great conversation. Some of them, like I dropped into one with a lawyer and she was doing a valiant effort. There were, I think, six people in the room. And again, everybody knew, you know, that it wasn't, I mean, the tables were capped at eight. So we had six people in the room and like only one person would answer questions or say something. So that was tough. What I took from that is, and I'm excited about our March event, is to really do a better job of scripting the roundtables and do a better job, I think, of leading up to the event, informing all the attendees. Like, come prepared with a story. Come prepared with questions. You know, don't sit in these rooms and have nothing to say, because the whole reason you would come to a pharma salon event is you get to sit in a room and talk to the speakers and talk to the other people. So I'm going to make sure that speakers know to go around the room and introduce themselves, ask why are you here or what are you hoping to learn, and you know, that kind of thing to start the conversation.
You're going to stay away from any of the technology stuff. You're not building a technology platform. That's all going to be there. You can puzzle that together.
Since August, there's been an explosion of companies that are geared up to this space. So we are going with a company called Hopin, which I think is going to be really good. It just has everything we need, including like networking. And it's a neat program. But yeah, I don't need to build it. It's there. It's there now.
Now, I ain't no genius, but I'm thinking this. I'm thinking you've got to get the right speakers, but you also have to have a way to rate the participants. So they need a rating, because you don't want a table of six and have this a-hole guy like at the that event where he got up and talked about himself. You want people that speak enough at the table, but you also want someone that's going to be able to work well in the group. And so I think that you've got to rate the people somehow. But how would you do that without embarrassing people and so on? I mean, I would do it once and they'd say, we don't want him there. But the participation is going to be interesting of how much you have people participate, right?
There's an evolution that went on. I think we talked about this briefly once before. And this all started out when I started doing unconference sessions, which is I would just put a topic on a table and anybody wanted to sit at that table, they could sit and chat to everybody else at that table. Nine times out of 10, people loved it because it gives you a break to the day. It's just a very free flow conversation. But what you just said is exactly what would happen on occasion. You'd have one guy dominating the entire conversation and nobody else could get a word in it, or two. So I introduced a moderator. The challenge is to educate the moderator enough to let the free flow conversation going without it being dominated. And that's the speaker as well, like, because we do design bullet points and objectives. And I keep trying to emphasize them. This is actually kind of meant to be a free flowing conversation.
Even the presentation.
For the roundtables, we don't always have presentations. Some of them are more formalized and they do a 10-minute presentation. But the idea is like, let the conversation grow organically without having one or two people dominate it. And at the same time, trying to make sure that everybody kind of gets maybe what they want. And I think, you know, I haven't really thought of this, but, you know, you do tend to use a lot of the same speakers. And maybe with the time, and I'm hoping that this is an easy buy-in because it's online and a lot of these roundtables, you don't really have to prepare a presentation or anything like that. As they do it more, they'll get more experience. You know, like anything else, you get more experience with it. So maybe after a couple of times, they know how to better manage that conversation or make sure it goes really smoothly. Initially, it's up to the moderator to make sure that one or two people don't dominate a conversation and at the same time be able to pull other people out of their shell to participate in the conversation.
If I'm coming to a pharma salon thing, it'd be interesting to know who was in my group. Because, for example, arguably, I'm going to see some of these people online already. I know it's a roundtable and they're not presenting, but I think it would be cool to sit down with Bob from Bob's Pharmacy in Kansas, because I see some of the stuff he does, but I'd rather not sit with, you know, Mary from Mary's Pharmacy in South Dakota, because she's always online spouting political things or something like that. That'd be tough to do though, wouldn't it?
Actually, you know, one of the softwares, the backbones I considered had something that would solve that problem. And now you're making me think I should go back there, but they were missing some others. That's the problem, is nobody has it all. So they had a quote unquote room. It was the main room, which you could, it was actually set up, you know, like, have you seen floor plans with tables in it? Like, have you ever done a wedding or something or whatever? So there's, it's like a floor plan, right? And you see the round circle for the table and you see all the chairs around it, you know, and all the tables that are in the room. They had it so you could go into that room and you'd see who was sitting at what table. And then you could put a name on that table. So topic A, you know, you could come in, you could say, okay, here's topic A. And it's got, like you said, it's got Bob, Mary, and Jean, but this table has, you know, Sid, Nancy, and Quincy. Which, like you said, that is kind of neat that you could just go. And I liked that idea too, because one of the things I was thinking that we were talking about was it would be fun because you could also just have a blank table. Let's say somebody just wants a break and to hang out with some people. You know, they would go to that table and do that.
I don't know if you've ever heard of, it's called the traveling salesman computer problem, where if you've got like, actually they study bees to do this. They see where the bees go to the flowers and what flowers they go to first and so on. Because if you've got like 10 places for a salesman to go and you want to see what their best route is, there's computers that can't even handle that. It goes up so high because of that doubling of the numbers. Here's another thing you could do is maybe you don't have names on it, but you've got a few things like he's a new compounder versus he's opening one up. And then someone could say, well, I don't want to be with a new guy. Or they might say, I want to be with a new guy to get new ideas because he's maybe this or he or she's maybe this or that. So maybe you could do it without names. It would be like the dating game. You remember that?
Well, yeah, of course.
Contestant number two, I've got a 1 pound jar of Eucerin. Tell me, what do I do with that? You know, one of those kind of things.
Yeah. I mean, you could set up like a sign-up sheet maybe beforehand, just before the event, and
that's tricky, but that's what you get paid for.
It's what I make the big bucks for.
That's where you differentiate yourself from people saying, hey, no, we're just going to get a group together and chat. It's like, no, do it this way, because Vivian, she's done this her whole life. She knows how people work. She's had success. She's had a couple failures to learn from. She's the pro. That's why we're going to do this through PharmaSalon. That's that.
That's that.
Where does this go after COVID? What do you think the live mix versus online is going to be?
People have been promoting a long time trying to do online events, you know, whether it be webinars and things like that. And they just, I don't know, they haven't really been accepted. A lot of this stuff has been around, but they've never really taken full, you know, they never really achieved, I think, the kind of mass acceptance. So as a conference producer, we now have people who are very comfortable doing this in the space, in the online space. There's a lot of benefits. I mean, you know, it's an easier buy-in, it's an easier sell. You don't have to go anywhere. You can pick and choose what you want to participate in. The pros and the cons are it's a lot less immersive. So I think moving forward, what a lot of conference people are looking at is hybrid events. And that's certainly what we want to plan. If you want to get out of the office and come, and that's why I think, like for me, I think location events are going to become more interesting. You know, a destination event becomes more interesting than one that's closer to the airport and easy access. Because the reality is, I think people who come to these events are going to want to be there because they want to see people, they want to be in a nice place, they want to get out of the office. And if they don't, they're going to be able to access online. So we'll be offering, you know, I'll have the full AV team there recording everything and having the online thing going on at the same time as the live event going on. And I think that's what's going to be really exciting and interesting in the future.
You know, even some churches are doing that around where they've got like the main pastor is like 10 miles away. And then they've got these satellite churches where people still even go to the church, but you've got just a big screen up there and it's like 5 miles away. They just can't fit so many people in there. Let's say you have a speaker. I know you don't always. Let's say you have a speaker. They might give it live to half the people and half the people might be watching it online. And then you might have some breakout groups. And
exactly. And in a perfect world, I've got somebody in at the hotel, you know, at the live event, managing those round tables and everything that goes on there. And I've got somebody online managing the virtual round tables and what's going on there. So if you have a large group of people online, they're still getting the benefit of the networking. And then, as you know, like with the speaker on stage, they can still submit questions and stuff like that.
Which one you have coming up then?
It's called the Compounding Pharmacy Business Salon. And I got this from a lot of people who said, yes, we're all focused on, you know, a lot of the technical stuff, but there's not enough people talking about, you know, kind of the nuts and bolts of the business side. So I'm pretty excited because it's divided into three tracks. One is marketing, because there's not a lot of people talking about marketing, especially for the 503As, you know, the independent pharmacies. You know, the 503Bs are pretty corporate and, you know, they kind of know what their role is. And it's for both. But so we've got the marketing track, the operations track, which is just, you know, just trying to figure stuff out, like budgeting issues. You know, how do you navigate certain budgeting decisions that need to be made? You know, just SOPs, things like that. And I'm actually super excited as well about the third track, which is opportunities. I really wanted to explore where the compounding pharmacy business is going in the future.
When is this in March?
March 24th. And it's one day event. So
pharmasalon.com, right?
Right. And I also want to mention one of the benefits to being online is all this, that, you know, we have all this content in one day. And obviously everybody's not going to be able to hit all the sessions. So one of the benefits online is that all of these are recorded and there you can get CE credits for them. So anybody who registers can pick and choose the sessions they want to go to and they want to participate in. And then if they need the CE credits or they're just curious, they can download all the videos afterwards and watch them on their own time frame. And I think that's a huge advantage to the online space.
Okay, wait a minute though. I got to play devil's advocate on this one. So you spend the time and the money and the effort, and you've got people that are drooling over these three different tracks, but then they can only do one of them. It would seem, and I ain't no genius, but it would seem that there's a way to let them go to all three of them somehow. Like maybe like an extended day if they do this or that.
There you have it. That's the challenge in the online space is, yes, people want to go to all three, but they don't want to spend 3 days online.
They wake up and they eat cereal at their desk and they just sit there and they're not at work, but they're at home.
Exactly. So, and then the challenge as well is, again, when we had this August event, it was a half day event. You know, we had to do a half day event because of the time zones.
You needed 3 hours early and 3 hours later here to match them up.
Yeah. But the challenge is since August, even now, everybody is doing Zoom events, including the company. So people are spending so much time focused on Zoom. The thought of spending 4 hours over 3 days at one event, they're not super excited about, even if they're excited about the content.
They might get overwhelmed and they're going to say, I'm not going to do any of it.
Exactly. I can't sit and process this much information in 3 days. So I agree with you. It's not ideal because I do believe everybody will want all 3 days. At least they can say, you know what? I am really interested to hear about, you know, that 503As in precision medicine. And I really want to hear about how I'm, you know, that case study about that guy who was able to sell his product and expand his business by working better with doctors. And I really want to hear how I can kind of budget and build or prepare for automation. But I can't take off the 3 days. So that way, at least, and again, it's not ideal, but at least they can say, I do want to hear this other information. I am interested in it. And I also need my CE credits. So they can say, all right, these are the ones I really want to hear. And then I'm going to spend the next month downloading the others. So at least I can hear about it. And at least I can get my CE credits at a more leisurely pace. And that it was going to carry through to the hybrid event. So what I'll do is everything is recorded. So let's say people are online and they can't make all 3 days the same. You know, if they can't do it, they will still have the ability to download all the recordings and get their CE credits for 1 month after the event.
Here's what I would think. Let's say they're doing it in their house. It'd be nice to have something included to make them feel the same specialness or relaxation they have as if they went somewhere. Like maybe you send over a masseuse to their house, or this marijuana stuff is getting more popular. Maybe you send along with the sign up a little goodie box. There you go. A goodie box that has like special cologne or perfume. It's got some marijuana in it. It maybe has like a back roller, but something to give them the feeling of being at this hotel, but they're sitting at home in their pajamas. Well, Vivian, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you, Mike. It's been really fun.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.